If you look at any major engineered structure, you know, a nuclear reactor casing, a submarine hull, or a huge bridge, it's built using high-strength steel.
Absolutely. And every single piece is held together by a weld.
Now, if I asked you what determines that structure's resilience, you might instinctively say, well, the grade of steel used.
That's the logical assumption.
But here's the hook. The true destiny of that structure, whether it's tough or prone to catastrophic, brittle failure, that's actually decided in the first few seconds of cooling.
And at a submicron level, right in that tiny region where the two pieces of metal were fused together. It's the ultimate paradox of materials science.
We're looking at something massive, but the failure mechanism is purely microscopic.
Exactly. When we examine high-strength steel welds, the difference between reliable robustness and, well, catastrophic failure comes down entirely to specific non-equilibrium phase transformations.
And these are happening hundreds of degrees below the melting point.
That's right. It's all about the kinetics.
And today, we're going deep into the literal source code for this process. Our source material is foundational.
It really is one of the most cited pieces of work in modern physical metallurgy.
It's a dense, highly technical 1987 PhD dissertation from Cambridge University, authored by Jaren Yang, under the guidance of Dr. H.K. D.H. Padatia.
And this work, it really provided the scientific roadmap for designing the high-performance welds we use today.
So our mission today is to give you the ultimate decoder ring for this highly complex material system.
We want you to quickly grasp the core counterintuitive findings about what generates toughness in these low-alloy steel welds. We're talking about your typical SCC-CNMO alloys.
And we're going to focus on the microscopic star of the show, a phase called acicular ferrite.
And the surprising kinetic and thermodynamic truths that govern how it forms and how it disappears.
Okay, let's set the stage for segment one, the desirable structure. To study this, Yang investigated weld deposits made using a classic industrial process, manual metal arc welding.
Right, and the goal was to see what phases formed when that liquid metal from the weld solidified and then cooled down really, really fast.
So when steel cools, you have this initial high-temperature phase, austenite, which we call gamma.
And it wants to transform into the stable room temperature phase, ferrite or alpha. But in a weld, cooling is just too fast for that to happen perfectly.
So you don't get the ideal equilibrium structure.
Not at all. Instead, you get a mixture of phases. You get something called allotriomorphic ferrite, or alpha, which nucleates on the boundaries of the original austenite grains.
Then you have Widmann-Stettin ferrite, which looks like these big internal plates.
And then you have the structure we all want, acicular ferrite, alpha.
Acicular ferrite is the key. Its presence correlates directly with vastly improved strength and critically superior toughness.
Yeah, it has this fine needle-like or thin plate morphology. And in the successful welds they studied, the microstructure was mostly acicular ferrite.
With just minor amounts of other stuff like residual austenite or martensite.
So the big mystery Yang was tackling was, how does this specific tough microstructure form under these crazy non-equilibrium welding conditions?
And this is where the findings get really interesting. It reveals something called the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Right. This is the first major takeaway for you. The formation of acicular ferrite and its cousin, bainite, it doesn't actually run to completion.
It just stops prematurely.
Yeah, imagine a chemical reaction that just decides to quit halfway through. That's what's happening.
So why? Why does the transformation just stall?
The reason is purely thermodynamic. And it all comes down to carbon. As the ferrite structure forms, it has no room for the small carbon atoms.
So it kicks them out.
It rejects them from the transforming ferrite, and the carbon piles up in the surrounding residual austenite. It's like a traffic jam forming around a construction site.
And what happens when that carbon traffic jam gets too dense?
Well, once the carbon concentration in that residual austenite hits a critical threshold, which is defined by something we call the T0 temperature curve, the reaction just loses its thermodynamic driving force.
And T0 is where the ferrite and austenite of the same composition have equal free energy, right?
Exactly. The energy advantage needed to push the transformation forward just disappears, and the whole thing stops. Carbon is quite literally the brake pedal.
That is a crucial insight. It tells us this transformation is not driven by simple carbon diffusion like perlite is.
Right.
And that leads us to the study's central and maybe most provocative conclusion. It gives acicular ferrite a bit of an identity crisis.
Absolutely. The study concluded unequivocally that acicular ferrite is, in fact, bainite.
Wait, if it's technically bainite, Why did the industry call it acicular ferrite for decades? Is it just a different name for the same thing?
That's a great question. It's kinematically identical, but it looks different. It's morphologically different.
How so?
Well, the key is the displacive mechanism. Instead of atoms individually hopping around, which is diffusion, large groups of atoms shift together in a shear-like motion, almost instantaneously.
Like pushing a deck of cards sideways.
Perfect analogy. That fast, shear-based movement is what defines bainite. But acicular ferrite looks different under the microscope because of where it decides to start growing.
So the difference isn't the mechanism but the starting point, the location of nucleation.
Precisely. Conventional bainite and that allotriomorphic ferrite we mentioned, they typically nucleate on the austenite grain boundaries.
But acicular ferrite is different.
Very different. It nucleates intragranularly, right inside the large austenite grains. It needs a special kind of seed to get started.
That brings us perfectly to segment two, kinetics and control. If these seeds are vital for this desirable structure, we need to know what they are.
Right. If acicular ferrite is the key to toughness, then these nonmetallic inclusions are the unsung heroes of the world.
They're what, tiny particles of oxides and silicates?
Oxides, silicates, and sulfides, usually between 0.3 and 1 micron in diameter. And they're complex, with elements like iron, manganese, titanium, aluminum.
This is fascinating. We're talking about components that are often seen as dirt or an impurity in the steel.
But here they are. Absolutely essential for forming the toughest structure. They act as active nucleation sites.
So they lower the energy barrier for the transformation.
That's it. They ensure the new ferrite structure starts growing inside the grain, which promotes that chaotic, interlocking, fine plate structure that is just so good at stopping cracks from propagating.
Now, the source noted something counterintuitive about those inclusions. It wasn't just about the total amount of oxygen or dirt.
Right. The overall oxygen content, which ranged from about 120 to over 400 parts per million, was less important than the chemical complexity and the size distribution of the specific inclusions.
So it's not about quantity. It's about the quality of the nucleation site.
Exactly. Having the right mix of, say, titanium, manganese, and silicon oxides, that's what mattered for creating the perfect platform.
And speaking of composition, the study also looked at how alloying elements act as control knobs, shifting the entire kinetic landscape.
Mm.
Let's talk about molybdenum.
Molybdenum, or Mo. It's a powerful addition. Yang's research varied it from almost none to over half a weight percent.
And it has a powerful influence, as they put it.
Really does, primarily by increasing what we call the hardenability of the steel.
Okay, so for those unfamiliar, how does Mo physically change the transformation process?
Think of a time-temperature transformation curve, a TTT curve. It maps out how fast different structures form at different temperatures.
Right.
When you add molybdenum, it shifts the nose of that curve, the part representing the fastest transformation to the less desirable phases. It shifts it way over to the right.
So it's a chemical delay. It slows down the formation of the easy boundary nucleated stuff.
It's acting like a chemical speed bump. It forces the steel to take the slow road of cooling, allowing the temperature to drop into the zone where acicular ferrite, our desirable bainite, becomes the kinetically favored product.
And this research didn't just observe these effects, it quantified them.
Precisely. By understanding the thermodynamics, the T0 curves, and the kinetics, the TTT curves, they developed a comprehensive predictive model.
Which is the holy grail for a modern engineer. A model that integrates composition, cooling rate, all the phase diagrams to predict the final microstructure.
It was a monumental shift. It moved the development of new alloys from expensive, time-consuming, empirical guesswork, you know, just trying stuff until it worked.
To a grounded, scientifically predictive capability. It put materials development on a computer screen instead of just in the lab furnace.
That's the legacy.
Now, for segment three, we have to flip the process on its head. So far, we've only talked about cooling down.
But welds are rarely done in a single pass. You deposit layer after layer, which means the previous layers are constantly being reheated.
Which brings us to the complex reverse reaction, re-austenitization, the transformation of ferrite back into austenite.
You can think of it as the material equivalent of a chef constantly tweaking yesterday's sauce. The microstructure of the previous layer is modified every single time a new bead is laid down.
So understanding the kinetics of this reheating is vital.
It's everything for maintaining integrity across the whole weld. The study looked at this using techniques like dilatometry, measuring the tiny expansion of the metal as it heats up.
And high-resolution microscopy, T-gamma.
Yeah, and they found a minimum temperature baseline. The reverse transformation only kicks off when the temperature gets above a specific point, which they called T gamma 1. For one structure, it was around 680 degrees Celsius.
And below that, nothing happens.
Nothing.
Now, the kinetics of this reverse transformation are governed by something completely different than the forward reaction.
That's right. Reosinitization is driven by long-range diffusion, unlike the fast partitioning of the small carbon atoms we talked about.
This requires the big atoms to move.
The sluggish long-range diffusion of the substitutional alloying elements, the big guys like manganese and nickel.
Let's break down that difference again for the listener, because the speed is key.
Okay, imagine the iron lattice is a stadium full of people. Carbon, the interstitial atom, is a tiny child who can weave quickly through the aisles.
Easy to move.
Very. But manganese and nickel, the substitutional atoms, they're large adults sitting in the seats. To move them, you have to move the seat itself, the iron atom. That movement is dramatically slower.
And it controls the speed of reoctinitization.
It's the bottleneck. The microanalysis data confirmed this. Using EDX, they showed that even after, say, 10 minutes at 680 C, the manganese and nickel were redistributing. They were starting to move into the newly forming austenite.
They're trying to catch up to the carbon.
And that tendency validates a technical concept called negligible partitioning local equilibrium, or NPLE. It means the whole reaction is trying to reach equilibrium, but the heavy atoms are holding it back.
So the theory predicted that the full transformation back to austenite would only complete at a much higher temperature.
Exactly. At a temperature, T gamma 2, where the overall alloy composition finally matches what the austenite needs to be at equilibrium.
So a delicate balance. The forward reaction is fast and shear-based, limited by light carbon atoms. The reverse reaction is slow and diffusion-based, controlled by the heavy ones.
All happening inside one tiny weld bead.
But the complexity doesn't end there. We have to address the area immediately next to the weld.
Yeah.
The heat-affected zone, or HAZA, in segment 4.
And the HAZ is often the weakest point in any welded structure.
It's the region of the base metal that didn't melt, but it got blasted with an intense, rapid thermal cycle.
And it's notorious in engineering. It's the location most susceptible to failure, to cracking, to a loss of properties.
The microstructure there is determined by two things, right? The peak temperature it reached and how fast it cooled.
That's it. And because the thermal gradients are so steep, the HAZ is actually divided into 5 distinct subzones.
Starting closest to the well.
You have the solid liquid transition zone, where some grain boundaries might have melted. Then, right next to that, is the one we worry about most, the coarse austenite grain zone.
That's where peak temperatures hit between, what, 1100 and 1450 Celsius?
Yes, and that's a major concern.
Why is that coarse grain zone so dangerous?
Because when you heat the steel that high, the original austenite grains grow extremely large. And when that coarse structure cools down quickly, it is highly prone to forming brittle microstructures.
Like massive plates of Widmansteton ferrite or even untempered martensite.
Exactly. And that structure is also really susceptible to hydrogen-assisted cracking, which is a huge failure risk in these steels.
Okay, then as you move further away, the peak temperature drops, and you get to the austenite grain refined zone.
Here, the thermal cycle is just right. It dissolves the original grain structure and then reprecipitates a much finer austenite structure.
And a finer grain is always better for toughness.
Always. Then you move into the partially transformed zone, and finally the tempered zone closest to the unaffected base material.
And the key takeaway from the study here is that these changes in grain size, from coarse to refined, dramatically affect what happens on cooling.
Absolutely. The rate of, say, allotriomorphic ferrite formation goes way up as the grain size gets smaller because there's just more boundary area for nucleation. You have to map all 5 subzones if you want to predict the integrity of the whole structure.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's pull out the 2 most mission-critical knowledge nuggets from this deep dive.
First, the key to a high-strength, tough weld is getting as much acicular ferrite as you can.
And this study proved that structure is fundamentally bainite. It's a shear-based displacive transformation.
And crucially, it only forms because it nucleates inside the grains on those tiny oxide or silicate inclusions. Those specific high-quality inclusions are the essential seeds for toughness.
Got it. And the second big nugget.
The reverse process, reostenitization, which is vital for multi-run welds, is driven by the slow, long-range diffusion of the heavy alloying elements like manganese and nickel.
Its kinetics are controlled by the slow movement of the big atoms.
Exactly. And this foundational work decades ago by decoding both the forward and reverse reactions. It provided the essential basis for the computer models we use today to predict weld microstructures.
A monumental achievement that helped turn metallurgy into a predictive science.
No question.
Which leaves us with a provocative final thought for you to mull over. The study showed that the acicular ferret transformation stops prematurely because carbon partitions out and hits that T0 ceiling,
yes,
slamming the brakes on the reaction.
Right, the self-limiting.
So, what if modern materials engineers could fully suppress that carbon partitioning? Maybe by alloying with elements that trap the carbon, or by using cooling rates we haven't yet mastered? What would the resulting theoretically maximum strength steel look like if you allowed that full displacive transformation to run all the way to completion? Think about that hidden universe in that microscopic weld. Every time you see a massive steel structure supporting our world.